Aristocracy is nothing more than well-dressed bankruptcy. When the Duke of Rothford looked down his patrician nose and instructed Beatrice Cole to know her place, he expected a specific reaction. He expected tears, or perhaps a stammering apology. He expected her to retreat to the soot-stained industrial wealth she had crawled out from. Instead, Beatrice offered him a mathematically perfect, violently sarcastic curtsy. Then she walked out. By Tuesday, she hadn't just found her place. She had purchased the 3,000-acre estate directly adjacent to his. The ballroom at the Earl of Devonshire's townhouse smelled of melting beeswax, wilted lilies, and the sour tang of nervous sweat masked by heavy French perfumes. It was stifling. Beatrice Cole stood near a suffocatingly large arrangement of hothouse roses, her back rigid. The corset beneath her heavy silk gown bit into her lower ribs with every shallow breath. The silk was too bright, a peacock blue that her father insisted screamed wealth, but which Beatrice knew just screamed. The women around her, wrapped in muted creams and faded pastels passed down through generations, looked at her as if she were a spill on a priceless rug. She hated London. She hated the game. But Thomas Cole, a man who had built a shipping empire from a single leaky barge on the Thames, wanted a titled grandson. And Beatrice, his only surviving child, was the currency he intended to spend to get one. Arthur Pendleton, the Duke of Rothford, stood across the room. He was a tall man, perpetually shadowed by his own ancestry. His evening coat was immaculately cut, though the velvet collar showed the faintest signs of threadbare exhaustion if one looked closely enough. Beatrice had looked closely. She noticed everything. She noticed the way he held his champagne flute, pinched tightly, as if he were afraid someone might steal the glass. She noticed the way his gaze swept over the room, calculating, dismissive, tired. Their introduction had been orchestrated by a desperate hostess looking to settle a debt with Beatrice's father. It had gone poorly from the first syllable. Arthur had been forced to ask her to dance. The waltz was a mechanical, bloodless affair. His gloved hand felt like wood against her waist. He did not look at her face. He looked at the diamond necklace resting on her collarbone, his expression souring as he mentally appraised the stones. "I am told your father's ships bring in half the coal in London, Miss Cole," Arthur had said. His voice was a slow drawl, sanded down by years of expensive boarding schools. "More than half, Your Grace," Beatrice replied, keeping her tone flat. She wasn't going to simper. "We also deal in iron and imported timber. The very timber, I believe, that currently holds up the roof of your hunting lodge." It was a tactical error. She knew it the moment the words left her mouth. She was nervous, and when she was nervous, she reached for facts. She reached for ledger entries. Arthur's jaw tightened. The faint smell of stale brandy and clove cigarettes wafted from his breath as he leaned in slightly. His pride was a brittle, dangerous thing. He was land rich and cash poor, a secret the entire ton knew but pretended not to. Being reminded of it by a woman whose hands, though scrubbed clean, came from a bloodline of manual labor, was intolerable to him. "How incredibly practical," Arthur murmured, steering her sharply around a corner. The music swelled, loud and grating. "But you will find, Miss Cole, that while iron and coal may buy you a ticket into this room, they do not buy you a right to speak of matters beyond your understanding. We are not your employees." Beatrice stepped out of the turn, her heel catching slightly on the polished floor. She recovered instantly, but her pulse hammered in her throat. "I meant no offense, Your Grace. Simply a statement of commerce." "Commerce." He spat the word as if it were a foul taste. The dance ended. He did not release her waist immediately, gripping her just hard enough to leave a bruise. He leaned closer, his voice dropping to a harsh whisper that cut through the polite applause. "This is not a dockyard. You are wearing your father's money like a loud bell around your neck. You would do well to know your place before society forces you into it." He stepped back. He offered no bow. Beatrice stood completely still. The physiological reaction was immediate and terrifying. Her ears rang. A cold sweat broke out along her hairline. It wasn't sorrow. It wasn't the crushing weight of heartbreak or a crushed maidenly spirit. It was rage. Pure, unadulterated, blinding rage. It tasted like copper in the back of her mouth. She looked at him. Really looked at him. At the arrogant tilt of his chin, the smug certainty in his eyes that he had just put a lesser creature back in her box. Her hands were shaking. She balled them into fists within the folds of her ostentatious gown. She didn't cry. She didn't flee. Beatrice locked eyes with the Duke of Rothford. The corners of her mouth twitched upward into a smile that did not reach her eyes. She gripped the heavy silk of her skirts, stepped one foot back, and sank into a curtsy. It was a masterpiece of a curtsy. It was slow, agonizingly precise, dipping so low her knee brushed the floorboards. It was the kind of deference one offered a reigning monarch, loaded with so much theatrical irony it became a profound insult. She held it for 3 full seconds. The silence in their immediate circle deepened. When she rose, Arthur's face had drained of color, realizing he had just been openly mocked. "Your Grace," Beatrice said softly, her voice steady despite the adrenaline flooding her veins. She turned on her heel. She did not run. She walked at a measured, deliberate pace out of the ballroom, down the grand staircase, and out into the damp, soot-stained London night. The smell of rain on cobblestones hit her, grounding her. "Take me home," she told her driver, climbing into the carriage. She ripped the diamond necklace from her throat. It left a red welt against her skin. She threw it onto the opposite seat. "Know her place." She stared out the window at the blurred gas lamps. Fine. She would find her place. And he was going to hate it. The Cole residence was not in Mayfair. It was situated squarely in a wealthy, robust neighborhood closer to the river, a physical manifestation of Thomas Cole's philosophy. Stay close to the work. The house smelled of burning sea coal, strong Assam tea, and floor wax. It was 7 in the morning. Beatrice sat in her father's study. The mahogany desk was massive, scarred by years of letter openers and heavy ledgers. Thomas Cole paced the length of the Persian rug. He was a broad-shouldered man, his knuckles still thick from his days pulling ropes, though he now wore tailored broadcloth. He looked at his daughter, who was calmly spreading a map of Hampshire across the desk. "You walked out," Thomas said, his voice a low rumble of disappointment. "Lord Devonshire's ball. Half the peerage was there, Bea. You made a spectacle." "I made an exit," Beatrice corrected, pinning down a curling corner of the map with a heavy brass inkwell. Her head throbbed. She hadn't slept. She had spent the night tearing through her father's extensive, privately commissioned dossiers on the financial standings of the landed gentry. "The Duke of Rothford insulted us. Specifically, he insulted our money." "They all insult our money," Thomas sighed, running a hand through his thinning gray hair, "until they need a loan. That is how the game is played, Beatrice. You swallow the pride, you get the ring, and then your son gets the title. You knew the plan." "For I am changing the plan," Beatrice said. She tapped a gloved finger on a specific patch of green on the map. "Rothford has 3,000 acres in Hampshire. The Pendleton estate. It's his pride and joy. It's also hemorrhaging money, but it's entailed. He can't sell it." "I know the Duke's finances. Why do you care?" Beatrice slid a secondary sheet of paper across the desk. It was a property ledger. "I don't care about his estate. I care about the one next to it. Oakhaven." "Yidda?" Thomas stopped pacing and leaned over the desk, squinting at the paper. "Viscount Harwick's property. It borders Rothford's land to the east." "Harwick is a degenerate gambler," Beatrice stated matter-of-factly. Her voice lacked judgment. It was simply a business metric. "He owes £40,000 to various syndicates in London. His creditors are threatening debtors' prison by the end of the month. The estate is not entailed. He inherited it free and clear from a distant uncle, and he has bled it dry." Thomas looked at his daughter. The anger in her eyes from the night before had cooled into something much harder, much sharper. It was the same look he had when he engineered a hostile takeover of a rival shipping line. A slow, proud smile broke across his weathered face. You want Harwick's land. I want Harwick's land, Beatrice confirmed. I have my own trust, Father. The money you set aside for my dowry, it is liquid. It is sitting in the Bank of England doing nothing but accruing 3%. I want to buy Oakhaven. It's a decaying pile of bricks, B. The roof likely leaks. I don't care if the house is a pile of rubble. I care about the property line. I want the deed. By noon, Beatrice was sitting in a cramped, stale-smelling solicitor's office in Chancery Lane. Viscount Horrocks sat across from her. He was a man in his late 30s who looked 50. His skin was sallow, his hands trembled constantly, and he reeked of stale gin and desperation. The collar of his shirt was frayed. Harwick stared at the bank draft resting on the table between them. It was for £45,000, enough to clear his debts and buy him passage to America, where he could start ruining his life anew. You... Harwick licked his cracked lips. You understand, Miss Cole, that the main house has not been updated since the reign of King George II? The north wing is practically uninhabitable due to dry rot. I am aware, my lord, Beatrice said. She wore a simple dark wool day dress. No peacocks today. No diamonds. Just the quiet, terrifying armor of absolute solvency. And the tenant farms, they yield very little. The soil is quite poor on the eastern ridge. Viscount Harwick, Beatrice interrupted gently.
The sound of rain lashing against the grimy window pane filled the silence in the room. I'm not buying your estate to become a cabbage farmer. I'm buying it because it shares a 2-mile property line with the Duke of Rothford, including the shared hunting woods. Harwick blinked. A flicker of understanding, followed by a dark, cynical amusement, crossed his tired face. Ah, Arthur, he is particular about his neighbors. I intend to test exactly how particular he is, Beatrice said. She nudged the bank draft a fraction of an inch closer to him. Sign the deed, my lord. Take the money. Go to New York. Or stay in London and let your bookmakers break your legs by Friday. The choice is yours. Harwick didn't hesitate. He grabbed the heavy fountain pen. The scratching of the nib against the thick parchment sounded remarkably like a match striking. As the solicitor stamped the final seal into the red wax, Beatrice felt a profound, heavy settling in her chest. The anger hadn't dissipated, but it had found a home. She rolled up the deed, tied it with a plain ribbon, and stood. She walked out into the London rain, the mud instantly splashing against the hem of her skirts. She didn't care. She owned the mud now. The carriage ride to Hampshire took 2 days. The roads were rutted. The carriage rattled her teeth, and the damp chills seeped into the marrow of her bones. But as the iron gates of Oakhaven finally loomed into view, Beatrice felt a surge of grim satisfaction. Harwick hadn't exaggerated. The estate was a disaster. The iron gates were rusted shut. Her driver and a hired footman had to use a crowbar to pry them open, the metal shrieking in protest. The gravel driveway was choked with weeds. The main house, a sprawling, asymmetrical Georgian monstrosity, looked like a dead thing rotting in the sun. Vines of ivy had infiltrated the brickwork, shattering windows in the east wing. Beatrice stepped down into the tall, wet grass. The air here was entirely different from London. It smelled of wet earth, decomposing leaves, and sharp pine. It was quiet. Too quiet. Right, Beatrice said, pulling her heavy woolen cloak tighter around her shoulders. She looked at her bewildered staff, a skeleton crew hired hastily in London. Do not unpack the good china. It will likely fall through the floorboards. Set up the kitchens, find a room that doesn't smell of mold for me to sleep in, and someone fetch the local land surveyor, immediately. While the staff scrambled to make a corner of the ruin habitable, Beatrice did not go inside. She requested a pair of heavy leather riding boots, men's boots, and a walking stick. She spent the first afternoon walking the western edge of her new property. Her property. The words felt strange, heavy, in her mind. The boundary between Oakhaven and the Duke of Rothford's estate was delineated by a crumbling, waist-high dry stone wall and a thick, ancient line of oak trees. On her side, the brush was overgrown, a tangled mess of briars and deadwood. On Rothford's side, the landscape was manicured. The grass was cropped, the trees perfectly pruned. It was a physical manifestation of their two worlds. Beatrice stood by the crumbling wall. She reached out and touched the mossy stones. They were cold, rough against her bare fingers. A sudden sharp crack of a rifle echoed through the woods, startling a flock of crows into the gray sky. Beatrice didn't flinch. She tracked the sound. Through the bare branches of the late autumn trees, she saw movement on the Rothford side. Two men on horseback, trailed by a pack of baying spaniels. One of the riders was Arthur Pendleton. He wore a tweed shooting jacket, his shotgun resting easily across his saddle. He looked entirely in his element, lord of the manor, master of his domain. Beatrice stepped closer to the wall. She deliberately snapped a thick dead branch from a briar bush, the crack echoing loudly in the quiet woods. Arthur reined his horse in. He turned his head, squinting through the trees. When he saw the figure standing by the boundary line, he urged his horse forward at a slow walk. He stopped 10 yards from the wall, looking down at her. He didn't recognize her at first. She was devoid of the peacock silk and the diamonds. Her hair was windblown, escaping its pins, and she was wearing mud-spattered men's boots. Then recognition dawned. It was slow. First, confusion knitted his brow. Then, a look of profound, bewildered shock, quickly followed by the return of his customary haughty irritation. "Miss Cole," Arthur said, his voice carrying easily over the damp air. "Are you lost? The public turnpike is 5 miles to the north." "I am precisely where I intend to be, Your Grace," Beatrice called back. She did not raise her voice to a shout, forcing him to strain slightly to hear her over the rustling leaves. Arthur's horse shifted restlessly. "This is private property, Viscount Harwick's land. He does not take kindly to trespassers, and neither do I." "Viscount Harwick no longer has an opinion on the matter," Beatrice said. She stepped up onto a solid section of the stone wall, bringing her eye level slightly higher, though still looking up at him on his horse. "I purchased Oakhaven 3 days ago. The deed is registered. I am your new neighbor." The silence that followed was absolute. Even the spaniels stopped panting. Arthur stared at her. His eyes darted to the decaying roof of Oakhaven, visible through the distant trees, then back to Beatrice. The muscles in his jaw worked furiously. He was a man who prided himself on control, on knowing exactly how the world worked. The daughter of a coal merchant buying a historic viscountcy's estate, just to spite him, did not compute within the rigid architecture of his reality. "You bought Harwick's estate," he repeated, his voice dangerously low. "Lock, stock, and barrel," Beatrice smiled. It was the same sarcastic, terrifying smile she had given him in the ballroom. "It seems we share a property line, Your Grace, and a hunting wood, though, looking at the surveyor's map, I believe this wall encroaches on my side by nearly 3 feet." Arthur's knuckles whitened on the reins. He urged his horse a step closer to the wall. The beast's hot breath plumed in the cold air, smelling of oats and leather. "You are playing a dangerous, foolish game, Miss Cole. You do not belong here. Buying dirt does not make you aristocracy. It makes you a tourist with a checkbook." "I don't want to be aristocracy," Beatrice said, her voice dropping the polite veneer entirely. It was raw, grounded. "I know exactly what aristocracy is. I saw it when I looked at Harwick begging for my money to pay his bookies. I see it when I look at the frayed cuffs of your evening coats." Arthur flinched. The hit landed perfectly. "I don't want your title, Rothford," she continued, stepping down from the wall, back into the mud of her own land. "I just wanted to make sure that every morning when you look out your east-facing windows, you have to look at me." She turned her back on him. She didn't wait for a dismissal. She didn't offer a curtsy. She just walked away, her heavy boots leaving deep, undeniable tracks in the Hampshire mud. Behind her, she heard the sharp, vicious crack of Arthur spurring his horse, the thud of hooves retreating rapidly into the manicured woods. Beatrice breathed in the smell of the damp earth. It smelled like a beginning. It smelled like war. Aristocratic silence is a fragile, expensive commodity. It requires vast tracts of empty land, perfectly oiled hinges, and servants trained to walk on the sides of their shoes. For 28 years, Arthur Pendleton had lived wrapped in that heavy, suffocating silence. On the 1st of November, at exactly 6 in the morning, the silence shattered. It did not break with a singular crash, but with a rhythmic mechanical assault, the thud of iron sledgehammers against crumbling brick, the shrill, grating screech of cross-cut saws tearing through green timber, the shout of 50 laborers echoing across the frosted valley. Thomas Cole had dispatched a small army from London. They descended upon Oakhaven like locusts, armed with scaffolding, mortar, and an unlimited budget. Arthur sat in his library, a leather-bound copy of Pliny open on his lap. He hadn't turned a page in 40 minutes. The library was in the east wing of his manor. It faced Oakhaven. Every blow of a hammer vibrated through the single-pane glass of his tall windows. He closed his eyes, rubbing the bridge of his nose where a dull, throbbing ache had taken up permanent residence. The faint smell of burning refuse, old rotted wood being incinerated in massive bonfires across the property line, seeped through the window frames. It smelled sour, like burning damp leaves and wet rot. A mile away, Beatrice stood in the center of what used to be the Viscount's grand foyer. She was shivering. The cold in Hampshire was different from London. London cold was choked with smog and body heat. This cold was sharp, clean, and aggressively indifferent. It sliced through the thick wool of her dark green walking dress. The air was thick with white plaster dust. It coated her eyelashes, making her blink rapidly, and left a chalky, dry taste on the back of her tongue. She looked up. A massive section of the ceiling had been torn out, exposing the rotting joists that had threatened to drop a chandelier onto her head the day before. The sky, a bruised, heavy gray, was visible through a gaping hole in the slate roof. "The rot goes straight into the load-bearing beams, Miss Cole," the head contractor, a gruff man named Miller, shouted over the din. He tapped a decayed beam with a crowbar. It yielded like wet cardboard. "Gonna take another 3 weeks just to stabilize the core. It'll cost you twice what we quoted." "Do it," Beatrice said, her voice flat, coughing slightly as a cloud of dust drifted down. "Double the shift. Bring men up from Southampton if you have to. I want a roof before the first snow." She walked out the front doors, stepping over piles of shattered slate and splintered wood. The initial high of her revenge had faded, replaced by the crushing logistical nightmare of her own stubbornness. Oakhaven was a money pit. She was bleeding capital to rebuild a house she didn't even want to live in, simply because she refused to retreat to London and admit the Duke had won. She walked down the gravel driveway, which had been churned into a thick, ankle-deep soup of mud by the constant procession of heavy supply wagons. As she neared the main road, she saw him. Arthur was sitting on a chestnut gelding, blocking the narrow country lane that served as the primary access route for both their estates. Behind him sat three heavy horse-drawn carts piled high with fresh limestone, effectively stalled. The drivers were arguing with Arthur's bailiff. Beatrice picked up her heavy skirts and marched toward the bottleneck, her boots squelching loudly in the mud. "Is there a problem, Your Grace?" she asked, stopping a few feet from his horse. Arthur looked down at her. His face was a mask of cold fury. He wore a heavy riding coat, the collar turned up against the wind. "Your wagons are destroying the access road, Miss Cole. The ruts are nearly 2 feet deep. My tenant farmers cannot get their grain carts to the village market." Beatrice looked past him at the deep, muddy trenches her limestone deliveries had carved into the soft earth. He was right. It was impassable for anything lacking a heavy draft team. "I have a right of way on this lane," Beatrice stated. though she felt a prickle of unease. The farmers had nothing to do with their war. "A right-of-way is not a license to obliterate the thoroughfare," Arthur snapped. The chestnut horse stamped its hoof, splattering mud onto the hem of Beatrice's dress. He didn't apologize. "You're flooding this valley with noise, smoke, and filth. This is a gentleman's county, not a dockyard expansion." Beatrice's jaw tightened. She stepped closer to the horse, ignoring the beast's restless shifting. She looked Arthur dead in the eye. "I will have my men dump a layer of crushed gravel on the road by tomorrow morning. It will hold the carts." "I don't want your gravel. I want your wagons off the lane." "Then build a catapult and launch the stone over your precious trees, Rothford," she fired back, her voice dropping to a harsh, quiet register. "Because the wagons aren't stopping. You wanted me to know my place. My place is here, knee-deep in mud, fixing what your peers left to rot." She turned and signaled to her drivers to push forward. "Move the carts!" she shouted. Arthur's bailiff looked at the Duke, awaiting an order. Arthur stared at Beatrice's retreating back. His knuckles were bone white on the leather reins. For a second, he looked entirely out of his depth, a man fighting an industrial tide with a silver spoon. He yanked the reins sharply, turning his horse, and galloped back toward his quiet, decaying manor, the sound of hoofbeats quickly swallowed by the rhythmic, deafening crash of sledgehammers. Winter arrived in mid-December, not with a picturesque dusting of snow, but with a vicious, howling gale that swept off the English Channel. It battered the Hampshire countryside for 3 days, stripping the last of the dead leaves from the oaks and turning the ground to iron. Inside Oakhaven, Beatrice huddled in the one completed parlor in the west wing. The rest of the house was sealed off behind heavy canvas tarps that flapped violently in the drafts. The air in the parlor smelled intensely of burning pine. She had 3 fireplaces blazing, yet she still wore a thick woolen shawl over her day dress. Her fingers were stiff, the skin around her knuckles cracked and dry from the constant cold. She was balancing a ledger on her knees, the numbers blurring together. The sheer cost of the roof alone made her stomach turn. A loud, thunderous crack snapped her attention away from the ink columns. It didn't sound like a hammer. It sounded like the earth itself tearing open, followed by a sustained, violent crash that shook the floorboards beneath her feet. Beatrice dropped the ledger. She grabbed a heavy wool cloak, throwing it over her shoulders as she ran toward the front doors. The wind nearly knocked her backward as she stepped outside. The sky was the color of a bruised plum. She scanned the tree line. On the eastern border, the ancient line of oaks that divided her property from Rothford's had been breached. A massive, towering oak, easily 300 years old, had been uprooted by the gale. It had crashed downward, obliterating a 50-foot section of the stone boundary wall. Worse, it lay squarely across the public turnpike that connected the back half of Rothford's estate to the village. Beatrice pulled her hood up, securing it tightly beneath her chin, and began the long, muddy trek toward the boundary line. By the time she arrived, her lungs were burning from the frigid air. The sheer scale of the fallen tree was staggering. The trunk was wider than she was tall, a tangled mess of splintered branches and tearing roots exposed to the gray sky. It smelled powerfully of raw, split wood and damp earth. On the other side of the trunk, through the thick, broken branches, she saw movement. Arthur. He was not on a horse. He was on foot, ankle deep in the freezing mud. He had stripped off his heavy coat and stood in his shirt sleeves and a waistcoat, despite the biting wind. He was wielding a heavy, rusted felling axe, swinging it with vicious, rhythmic strikes against a thick branch blocking the road. Beside him, 2 elderly men, his groundskeeper and a tenant farmer, were pulling uselessly at a smaller branch with a frayed rope. They looked exhausted, their faces pinched and red from the cold. Arthur swung the axe again. The thud of metal biting into green wood echoed hollowly. He ripped the blade free, his breath pluming in the air. He was sweating. A streak of dirt was smeared across his cheek. He swung again. It was a pathetic, magnificent display of futile stubbornness. The tree weighed several tons. 3 men and an axe were not going to move it. The road would be blocked for weeks. Beatrice stood on her side of the wreckage, watching him. Her anger, usually so accessible, so hot, felt suddenly cold and heavy. This wasn't a ballroom. There was no audience. Just a desperate man trying to hack his way through a wall of wood to keep his estate functioning. "You're going to freeze to death, Rothford," she yelled over the howling wind. Arthur froze, mid-swing. He lowered the axe, peering through the tangled branches. When he spotted her, wrapped in her expensive cloak, a flash of pure, humiliated rage crossed his face. "Go back to your fire, Miss Cole," he shouted back, his voice ragged. He raised the axe again. "That trunk is 4 feet thick. You can't chop through it," she called out, stepping closer to the massive root system. "The road is blocked. Your tenants won't get their winter coal deliveries." "I am aware of the situation," he gritted out, slamming the axe into the wood. A large wood chip flew past his face. He ignored it. Beatrice watched the muscles in his back strain beneath the fine linen of his shirt. He was fighting the tree the way he fought the modern world, with outdated tools and blind aristocratic arrogance. "I have 30 men on site," Beatrice yelled. "I have a steam-powered traction engine and heavy logging chains. I can have this cleared by nightfall." Guo's son Arthur stopped. He rested the head of the axe on the mud, leaning heavily on the handle. He stared at her through the dead leaves. The wind whipped his dark hair across his forehead. He was breathing hard. Accepting her help meant accepting her money. It meant admitting his own impotence on his own land, to the daughter of a coal merchant. "No," Arthur said. The word was not shouted, but it cut cleanly through the wind. Beatrice's eyes narrowed. "Don't be a fool. Pride doesn't heat a cottage. Your people need the road." "I said no." He turned his back on her, gripping the axe handle with hands that Beatrice could see were blistered and raw. "We will clear it. Stay on your side of the line." He swung the axe. Beatrice stood in the freezing wind for 5 long minutes. She watched the axe rise and fall. She watched the slow, agonizing progress. She wanted to feel triumphant. She had wanted to see him brought low, but watching him bleed over a piece of wood just to avoid asking for her help didn't taste like victory. It tasted like ash. She turned sharply and walked back toward Oakhaven. When she reached the courtyard, she found Miller, her contractor. "Miller," she barked, her voice shaking slightly from the cold. "Fire up the traction engine. Get the heavy chains and 20 men. Go to the east boundary." "Miss Cole? The roof?" "The roof can wait. There's an oak tree blocking the turnpike." Miller frowned. "That's on the Duke's land, mostly." "Half of the roots are on my property." "It's an eyesore," Beatrice lied smoothly. "Clear it. If His Grace objects, tell him you are following my orders to clear my property line and you lack the precision to avoid his half of the road." She went inside, slamming the heavy door against the wind. She sat back down by the fire, picking up her ledger. She didn't look out the window when she heard the distant, mechanical shriek of the steam engine rolling down the lane. The invitation was printed on heavy, cream-colored cardstock. It smelled faintly of lavender and old dust. It was an invitation to the annual Christmas assembly hosted by the local parish in the village hall. Beatrice held it between 2 fingers as if it were contaminated. It was not a welcoming gesture. It was a summons. The local gentry, having watched the smoke rise from Oakhaven for 2 months, had decided it was time to formally inspect the invader. She considered throwing it into the fire. But Thomas Cole had not raised a coward. The village hall was a drafty stone-floored building that smelled overwhelmingly of damp wool, beeswax candles, and cheap, heavily spiced punch. The room was crowded, the heat from bodies failing to combat the chill radiating from the walls. Beatrice arrived entirely alone. She wore a gown of midnight blue velvet. It was expensive, brutally understated, and completely devoid of the peacocks and diamonds her father favored. She wore no jewelry save for a simple gold watch pinned to her bodice. The moment she stepped through the doors, the ambient chatter dropped by a noticeable octave. Eyes slid toward her, appraising, judging, dismissing. She walked to the far side of the room, standing near a fireplace that was drawing poorly. The smoke stung her eyes, but it kept the crowd at bay. Across the room, standing near the punch bowl, was Arthur. He was wearing an evening coat that, in the dim flickering candlelight, looked almost black. He was surrounded by a sycophantic orbit of local squires and their wives. They leaned in when he spoke, laughing a fraction of a second too late at his dry remarks. Beatrice watched him. He looked utterly bored. His eyes scanned the room, sliding over the heads of his admirers, until they locked onto hers. He didn't look away. Since the incident with the tree 3 weeks prior, they had not spoken. The road had been cleared by her men. Arthur had not sent a note of thanks. Beatrice had not expected one. "It seems the London smoke has followed us to Hampshire," a loud, booming voice declared, cutting through the low murmur of the room. Beatrice turned. A stout, red-faced man with impressive mutton-chop whiskers was standing a few feet away, holding a cup of punch. It was Mr. Higgins, a local squire whose primary claim to fame was owning the second-largest estate in the county, trailing far behind Rothford. He was looking directly at Beatrice, but speaking loudly enough for his immediate circle to hear. "One can hardly breathe in the valley these days for the dust and the soot. Terrible business, letting merchant money buy up good soil." A few of the women in his circle tittered nervously behind their fans. Beatrice's posture went rigid. The velvet of her gown felt suddenly too tight. She looked at Higgins. He was a small, petty man, wielding his minor gentility like a blunt club. She opened her mouth to eviscerate him, to quote the exact plummeting value of his wheat yields compared to her bank balance, when a shadow fell across them. "Higgins," a quiet, resonant voice said. The crowd parted instantly. Arthur stood there. He did not look at Higgins. He was looking at the smoke billowing from the fireplace behind Beatrice. "Your Grace," Higgins stammered, his red face flushing a deeper crimson. He bowed slightly, sloshing his punch. "We were just remarking on the changes to the valley." Arthur slowly turned his gaze to Higgins. The boredom in his eyes had been replaced by a cold, flat contempt. It was the same look he had given Beatrice in the ballroom, but weaponized differently. "The only change to the valley, Higgins, is that someone is finally fixing the rot at Oakhaven," Arthur said, his voice carrying easily through the suddenly quiet room. "A rot, I might add, that the rest of us ignored for a decade while Harwick drank himself into the gutter." Higgins's mouth opened and closed like a landed trout. "I merely meant the noise, Your Grace, the industrial nature of it." "It is the sound of solvency, Higgins. I suggest you accustom yourself to it." Arthur didn't wait for a reply. He dismissed the man entirely by turning his back to him. He took 2 steps toward Beatrice, stopping just outside what would be considered an intimate distance. The smell of clove cigarettes and clean snow clung to his coat, cutting through the scent of the smoky room. Beatrice stared at him, genuinely shocked. Her heart gave a strange, uneven thud against her ribs. He hadn't defended her out of chivalry. He had done it because Higgins's sycophancy suddenly disgusted him more than her money did. "Miss Cole," Arthur said quietly, ignoring the dozen pairs of eyes burning into their backs. "Your Grace," she replied, her voice cautious, tight. "Are you attempting to protect my honor?" A brief, dark humor flashed in his eyes. "Hardly. Your honor is heavily armored and armed to the teeth. I was simply protecting my own ears from Higgins's brain." He looked at her, really looked at her. He noticed the lack of diamonds. He noticed the shadows under her eyes. The exhaustion of managing a hostile estate in the dead of winter. "The tree was cleared," he said softly, the words feeling forced from his throat. "It was a hazard to navigation," Beatrice replied, maintaining the fiction. She refused to let him make it a favor. "My wagons needed the road." Arthur nodded slowly. He looked past her, into the poorly drawing fire. "My bailiff informs me your contractor has nearly finished the roof." "The west wing is sealed. The east wing is a ruin." "Oakhaven has always been a ruin," Arthur murmured, almost to himself. He looked back down at her. The rigid hostility that had defined every interaction they shared seemed momentarily to have cracked. It is a relentless, miserable place in the winter. Yes, Beatrice said honestly. The word slipped out before she could catch it. She sounded tired. Arthur's gaze softened, just a fraction. He shifted his weight, glancing back at the room of people who were pretending not to watch them. They will not forgive you for having money, you know, he said, his voice dropping to a murmur meant only for her. They will drink your tea, but they will never forgive you. I don't require their forgiveness, Beatrice said, lifting her chin, the familiar armor sliding back into place. And I don't require yours. Oh, Arthur stared at her for a long moment. A muscle worked in his jaw. The contradiction within him was almost physical, the ingrained prejudice of his blood warring against the undeniable reality of the woman standing in front of him. She was not a tourist. She was a force of nature. I'm beginning to realize that, Miss Cole, he said softly. He offered a short, crisp bow, a real one this time, and walked away, leaving Beatrice alone by the fire, the smoke stinging her eyes anew. February brought the thaw, and the thaw brought a misery entirely distinct from the freezing gale. The ground, locked tight for months, surrendered. It turned into a viscous, greedy swamp that sucked at boots and wagon wheels with a sickening, wet squelch. The air lost its sharp bite, replaced by the heavy, pungent stench of rotting snow, decomposing vegetation, and wet wool. Beatrice was walking the southern boundary line. Her heavy tweed skirt was caked in mud halfway to her knees, the dampness seeping through her wool stockings. She carried a thick ash walking stick, testing the ground before each step to avoid plunging into a hidden sinkhole. The boundary here was marked not by a wall, but by a winding, narrow brook that usually trickled quietly over smooth stones. Today, swollen by meltwater, the brook was a raging, muddy torrent, tearing away chunks of the soft bank. She heard the splashing before she saw the cause. It was a chaotic thrashing sound, accompanied by a pathetic, high-pitched bleating. Beatrice pushed through a thicket of bare hawthorn bushes, the thorns snagging and tearing at her sleeves. She reached the bank of the swollen brook. Down in the churning brown water, pinned against a mass of submerged, tangled roots, was a sheep. It was a massive, waterlogged ewe, its fleece heavy with mud, struggling weakly against the current. And thigh-deep in the freezing water, wrestling with the panicked animal, was the Duke of Rothford. Arthur had completely abandoned any pretense of aristocratic dignity. He was without a coat or waistcoat. His white shirt was plastered to his skin, nearly translucent, soaked in muddy water and sheep dip. The water rushed around his legs, threatening to knock him off balance. He had his arms wrapped around the ewe's middle, trying to heave the dead weight of the waterlogged fleece up the steep, slippery bank on his side of the brook. "Come on, you stupid beast," he ground out, his teeth chattering audibly. His boots slid in the submerged mud. He fell to one knee, the water surging up to his chest, but he didn't let go of the animal. Beatrice stood on her bank. The absurdity of it hit her first. The man who had sneered at commerce, who had told her she wore her money like a loud bell, was currently drowning in a ditch trying to save a 6-shilling piece of livestock. Then, the reality of the danger hit her. The water was dangerously fast, and the temperature of the meltwater was lethal. His lips were visibly blue. "Rothford!" Beatrice shouted over the roar of the water. Arthur's head snapped up. His dark hair was plastered to his forehead, dripping brown water into his eyes. He looked exhausted, wild, and shivering violently. He saw her, and for a split second she expected him to let the sheep go and climb out, letting pride override common sense. He didn't. He looked at the steep, eroding bank on his side, then at the slightly gentler slope on hers. "Grab her front legs!" Arthur yelled, his voice hoarse. He didn't wait for her consent. He shoved the thrashing ewe forward, leaning into the current, pushing the animal toward Beatrice's bank. Beatrice dropped her walking stick. She didn't hesitate. She stepped over the edge of the bank, sliding down the muddy incline until the freezing water swallowed her boots and soaked her heavy skirts. The shock of the cold punched the breath from her lungs. It felt like walking into a wall of knives. She reached out, grabbing a fistful of wet, filthy wool near the sheep's neck. The smell was horrendous, lanolin, mud, and panic. "Pull!" Arthur commanded, his hands shoving from beneath the animal's hindquarters. Beatrice dug her heels into the slick mud. She leaned backward, straining every muscle in her back and shoulders. The wet wool slipped through her fingers. She swore. A sharp, unladylike word picked up from her father's docks and grabbed the animal's front legs instead. "On three!" Arthur shouted, his face mere inches from the muddy water. "One, two, three!" He shoved upward with a guttural roar. Beatrice hauled backward. The ewe scrambled, its hooves flailing wildly, striking Beatrice in the thigh. But the combined momentum was enough. The sheep surged up the bank, collapsing onto the flat, soggy grass of Oakhaven, coughing up muddy water. Beatrice fell backward onto her rear, sliding a few inches down the slick mud. Her lungs burned, her arms trembled. She looked at the ewe, then looked down into the brook. Arthur was standing still, chest deep in the water. He was looking at his hands. They were scraped and bleeding, the knuckles raw from the roots. He was shaking so hard his shoulders violently vibrated. "Get out of the water," Beatrice said, her breath pluming. Arthur looked up at her. He didn't move. He looked completely defeated, stripped of every layer of defense he possessed. He waded slowly toward her side of the bank. It was the easier climb. He reached the edge, gripping the muddy roots. He tried to pull himself up, but his boots found no purchase. He slid back, the water splashing over his shoulders. Beatrice scrambled forward on her hands and knees. She reached out, grabbing his forearm. His skin was like ice. He flinched at the contact, his eyes darting to hers. "Give me your hand, Arthur," she demanded, using his given name for the first time. It felt sharp on her tongue. He didn't argue. He reached up, his large, mud-caked hand wrapping around her wrist. Beatrice braced her boots against a protruding root and pulled with everything she had left. Arthur surged upward, scrambling over the lip of the bank and collapsing onto the grass beside her. They lay there, side by side, staring up at the slate-gray sky. The only sounds were the rushing water, the bleeding of the sheep, and their ragged, uneven breathing. The smell of wet earth and sweat hung heavily between them. Beatrice turned her head. Arthur was staring at her. His face was smeared with mud, his teeth clicking together. "Thank you," he whispered. It was a ragged, raw sound. Beatrice looked at his blue lips, then down at the ruined silk of his fine shirt, torn at the shoulder, exposing bruised skin. The anger she had carefully nursed for months felt suddenly ridiculous, a child's toy left out in the rain. "You're a fool, Rothford," she breathed, pushing herself up onto her elbows. "You could have drowned." "It's my sheep," he replied stubbornly, though his voice lacked any real heat. He sat up, wincing as he moved his scraped shoulder. Beatrice reached over. She didn't think about it. She wiped a smear of thick mud from his cheekbone with her thumb. The skin beneath was freezing, the stubble rough against her cold, stiff fingers. Arthur went perfectly still. He didn't pull away. He looked at her hand, then slowly met her eyes. The space between them, vast and unbridgeable since the ballroom, suddenly contracted. It wasn't a softening, it was a realization. The mud didn't care about his title. The cold didn't care about her bank account. He reached up and wrapped his freezing fingers around her hand, stopping her movement. He held her hand against his cheek for 3 seconds. It was not a romantic gesture. It was a desperate grounding anchor. Then he let go. He pushed himself to his feet, swaying slightly. He grabbed the ewe by the scruff of the neck, dragging it back toward the shallow crossing further down the brook. Beatrice stayed on the muddy bank, watching him go. The wet wool of her skirt felt like lead, but her hand, where he had touched it, felt like it was burning. By late April, Oakhaven was reborn, The scaffolding had been dismantled, revealing clean, pointed brickwork. The roof was sealed with dark Welsh slate. Inside, the floors gleamed with beeswax. The plaster was dry and painted, and the fireplaces drew perfectly. The smell of rot was entirely gone, replaced by the scent of fresh linen, roasting meats from the kitchens, and lemon oil. Beatrice sat in her study. It was a masculine room by society's standards. Dark oak, heavy leather chairs, and walls lined with commercial ledgers rather than poetry. She wore a simple tailored day dress of slate gray. Her hands rested on the desk. They were no longer the soft, unblemished hands of a London debutante. There was a permanent callus on the inside of her right thumb from riding, and a pale scar across her knuckles from slipping on the wet scaffolding in March. She liked them better this way. A sharp rap at the heavy oak door startled her. "Enter," she called out. Her butler, a stern man hired from a respectable London household, stepped into the room. His face betrayed a profound internal struggle. "Miss Cole, the Duke of Rothford is at the front door. He is requesting an audience." Beatrice's pen paused over her ledger. A drop of black ink gathered, fell, and bloomed across the paper. She stared at it. "Did you show him to the parlor?" "He refused to enter the parlor, miss. He's standing in the foyer. Send him in here." A minute later, Arthur stepped through the door. He was dressed immaculately. A dark wool morning coat, a perfectly tied cravat, his boots polished to a high military shine. It was the armor he had worn in London, but it didn't fit the same way. The coat hung slightly loose on his frame, hinting at meals skipped. The aristocratic arrogance that used to radiate from him like heat from a furnace was gone, replaced by a tight, brittle tension. He stopped a few feet from the desk, his eyes sweeping the room. He noted the ledgers, the maps, the absolute, undeniable efficiency of the space. It was the polar opposite of his own chaotic, decaying library. "Your Grace," Beatrice said softly, standing up. She did not offer a curtsy. "Miss Cole," Arthur replied. He held a leather portfolio under his left arm. He gripped it so tightly his knuckles were white. "Please sit." She gestured to the leather chair opposite the desk. Arthur hesitated, then sat. The chair groaned slightly under his weight. He placed the portfolio on his lap. He did not speak immediately. The silence in the room stretched, thick and suffocating. The ticking of the grandfather clock in the corner sounded like hammer blows. Beatrice waited. She knew instantly what this was. She had seen men walk into her father's office with that exact look, the proud, hollowed-out look of a man who had reached the bottom of his reserves and was staring into the abyss of ruin. "You have finished the house," Arthur finally said, his voice terribly quiet. "It looks imposing." "It is dry, which is all I require of it," Beatrice answered, "though the east wing still drafts terribly when the wind comes off the channel." He nodded slowly. He looked down at his polished boots, then back up to her face. The internal contradiction practically vibrated off him. He was a duke. He was supposed to be the master of the county. He was supposed to order her away. Instead, he unbuckled the portfolio. "My father," Arthur began, his voice flat, stripped of all emotion, "was a man of expansive tastes and restricted foresight. When he died, he left the estate heavily mortgaged, 3 separate notes held by syndicates in London." Beatrice remained perfectly still. She knew this. Her father's investigators had found the debts in October. But hearing him say it, hearing him drag his family's shame into the open light of her study, was profoundly uncomfortable. It felt like watching a man flay himself. "The first 2 notes are manageable," Arthur continued, pulling a stack of heavy parchment from the portfolio and placing it on her desk. "The 3rd note, a balloon payment for £20,000, comes due next Friday. I do not have the capital. My tenant rents are fully allocated to keeping the roofs from caving in on their heads." He slid the parchment across the polished oak. "This is the deed to the Eastern Huntingwood, 400 acres of old-growth oak and pine. It borders your property line. It is not entailed. I am offering to sell it to you for £25,000. He removed his hand from the papers and sat back. He did not look away from her. His jaw was locked so tight, a muscle twitched near his ear. Beatrice looked down at the deed. It was the very land they had fought over, the land where she had mocked him from the wall, where he had swung his axe until his hands bled. He was cutting off his own arm to save the body. She felt a sudden, sharp ache in her throat. The victory she had plotted for in October was sitting right in front of her. She had won. She had driven him to his knees, forcing him to sell his family's legacy to the daughter of a coal merchant to avoid bankruptcy. It tasted like ash. Beatrice closed her eyes for a brief second. She took a breath, the scent of lemon oil filling her lungs. She picked up the deed. She looked at the wax seals, the elegant flowing script of the boundaries. Then she slid it back across the desk toward him. Arthur flinched. It was a microscopic movement, but Beatrice saw it. The rejection hit him like a physical blow. The color drained entirely from his face. "I see," Arthur said. He reached for the papers, his hand trembling slightly. "I apologize for taking up your morning, Miss Cole. I will take my business to London." "Leave the paper, Arthur." He froze. He looked at her, confusion warring with despair. "I do not want your hunting wood," Beatrice said, her voice steady, dropping the formal titles. "I have no use for 400 acres of trees, and cutting them down would ruin the sightline for my parlor. Then why..." "I am a businesswoman," Beatrice interrupted gently. She pulled a blank sheet of paper from her drawer and dipped her pen into the inkwell. "Your timber is valuable, but it takes capital to harvest it, mill it, and transport it. You lack the capital. I lack the raw materials for my father's shipyards. Selling the land solves your problem for a month, but strips you of a renewable asset. It is bad business." Arthur stared at her, perfectly silent. Beatrice began to write. "I will advance you £30,000, 20 to clear the syndicate note entirely, 10 to invest in a steam-powered sawmill on your property. In exchange, Coal Shipping receives exclusive at-cost rights to your timber yields for the next 10 years, minus a 20% profit share returning directly to the Rothford estate to fund your tenant repairs." She finished writing, signed the bottom with a sharp, aggressive flourish, and turned the paper around to face him. "This is not a purchase. It is a partnership." Arthur looked at the paper. He didn't read the words. He was looking at her. The rigid, aristocratic mask he had worn for 28 years fractured completely. "Why?" he whispered. The words sounded torn from his throat. "After everything I said to you, after the way I treated you, why are you doing this?" "Because," Beatrice said, her voice wavering for the first time, betraying the raw emotion she was trying to suppress. "I bought this house to spite you. I fixed it to prove I was better than you. And in the process, I realized that spite is a terrible cold foundation to build a life on. You love this land, Arthur. I saw it when you were freezing in that brook. You fight for it. I respect that." Arthur closed his eyes. A long, shuddering breath escaped his lips. The silence that followed wasn't heavy. It was the sound of a siege finally breaking. The rain started at twilight, a gentle, steady patter against the tall windows of the study. Arthur had not moved from the chair for an hour. They had gone over the terms, modifying the percentages, arguing over transport logistics. It was the first time they had spoken without weapons drawn. He was brilliant, Beatrice realized. Beneath the arrogance, he had a sharp, analytical mind that had been stifled by the rigid expectations of his class. He leaned forward, holding the final draft of the contract. He picked up her pen. He hesitated for a fraction of a second, the nib hovering over the paper. Then he signed. "Arthur Pendleton, Duke of Rothford." He placed the pen down carefully. He didn't hand the paper back immediately. He looked at the signature, then up at Beatrice. "In the ballroom in London," Arthur said, "the words heavy, deliberate. When I told you to know your place..." Beatrice stiffened. The memory still carried a phantom sting. "You don't need to apologize, Arthur. The contract is signed. The debt is settled. I am not settling a debt, he said, standing up slowly. He walked around the desk, stopping a foot away from her chair. He was too close. The smell of the rain on his coat, mixed with the faint scent of clove, enveloped her. I am admitting a profound, unforgivable ignorance. Beatrice looked up at him. She didn't move away. Her heart was hammering against her ribs, a frantic, caged bird. I was terrified, Arthur confessed, his voice dropping to a gravelly whisper. He looked down at her, his eyes searching hers, entirely stripped of pretense. I saw you in that ballroom, wearing the wealth that was slipping through my fingers, possessing a freedom I had never known. You were everything I was raised to resent, and you were magnificent. I insulted you because you made me feel entirely, completely powerless. Beatrice's breath hitched. She stood up. They were inches apart now. The height difference forced her to tilt her head back. She could see the faint exhaustion lines around his eyes, the pulse beating rapidly at the base of his throat. You told me to find my place, Beatrice said, her voice shaking, raw. She didn't want to be strong right now. She wanted the truth. I bought a ruined estate and froze in the mud for 6 months just to prove I belonged. You always belonged, Arthur said fiercely. He reached out. He didn't grab her hand this time. His fingers gently traced the line of her jaw, his thumb brushing against the pulse point on her neck. His hand was warm now, calloused from the axe, smelling faintly of ink. You didn't need a title, Beatrice. You built a kingdom while I was watching mine rot. The use of her given name, spoken without anger, without necessity, shattered the last remaining wall between them. Beatrice leaned into his touch. It was an imperceptible movement, but it was enough. Arthur's hand slid into her hair, gripping the thick coils at the nape of her neck. He pulled her flush against him. There was no hesitation, no polite, aristocratic restraint. He kissed her. It was not a gentle, flowery collision of souls. It was desperate. It was messy. It tasted like ink and relief. It was the collision of two people who had spent months fighting a war they were both secretly terrified of winning. Beatrice gripped the lapels of his coat, pulling him closer, feeling the solid, heavy muscle of his chest beneath the wool. She kissed him back with all the pent-up, violently suppressed emotion she had carried since London. She poured the mud, the cold, the sledgehammers, and the terrifying vulnerability of her own respect into the kiss. Arthur let out a low groan, shifting his weight, backing her slowly against the edge of the heavy oak desk. His mouth was demanding, entirely consumed by the reality of her. He broke the kiss, resting his forehead against hers, both of them breathing raggedly. I do not have a ring, Arthur whispered, his eyes closed, his hands tracing the curve of her spine. I do not have a fortune. I have a leaking roof and a title that means nothing in this room. Beatrice opened her eyes. She looked at the man who had ordered her to know her place. She reached up, framing his face with her hands, feeling the rough stubble along his jaw. I have the fortune, Arthur, she said, a slow, grounded smile breaking across her face. And I already fixed my roof. I suppose I can help you fix yours. Arthur let out a sound that was half laugh, half sob. He buried his face in the crook of her neck, holding her so tightly she could barely breathe. Beatrice wrapped her arms around his shoulders, burying her face in his dark hair. The scent of wood smoke and rain filled her senses. She looked over his shoulder, past the ledgers and the signed contract on the desk, out the window toward the boundary line. The wall was still broken. She had no intention of fixing it. If you felt the heat of Beatrice and Arthur's rivalry turn into an undeniable fire, hit that like button. This enemies-to-lovers historical drama proves that true power isn't in a title, but in the grit it takes to build your own empire. What was your favorite moment, the ballroom shutdown or the muddy rescue? Let me know in the comments.